It's about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place. This is News for the Rest of Us, free of corporate influence. Thomas et al. V. Canada is a class action lawsuit which was filed in the Federal Court of Canada in 2020 on behalf of Black Canadians employed in the Public Service of Canada. The action seeks to address and dismantle the systemic racism and discrimination within the Public Service of Canada, specifically for Black individuals who applied for employment with the Public Service and were denied entry based on their race, and those who were employed but were denied promotions based on their race, including those who have been employed within the past 5 decades. Rabble Labor reporter Gabriella Kaluge-Kasuga has been following this story as it developed, and this week she sat down with Bernadette Becci, a representative plaintiff who shared why seeking justice through the court is meaningful to her. Here is that conversation. Take a listen.
So hi, thank you so much for joining us on Rabble Radio today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So before we get into it, I thought, could you give a quick background on what the Black class action is for those who maybe have not been following this story?
Absolutely. So the Black class action was first introduced in December 2020. So basically, with that class action, we are demanding justice for Black workers all the way to, I think it was 1970s, and to current Black employees within the public service. And like I said, we're demanding justice for the violence that they have received, the systemic violence that they have received. So racism, discrimination, all of those type of oppressions, but also loss of wages, lack of promotional opportunities. And a lot of them, a lot of folks now who have retired are living under the poverty line because, you know, of that lack of promotional opportunities and retiring on a very low salary. So the best way I can explain this is that we're demanding justice a bit of a on a emotional and physical and mental justice, but also economical and financial.
I'm curious, how did you get involved as a representative plaintiff for this case?
So simply by having a conversation and being asked if I believed in the cause and if I wanted to join the fight. And I have a lot of lived experiences myself on these the oppressions that we're fighting, the discriminations that we're fighting. And I know so many people, and there's a lot of people I don't know, but I know that many are suffering. And so I wanted to do something. I wanted to be part of the solution. I wanted to be part of the people who didn't remain silent. And I wanted to bring all that energy into the cause and help the best way I can. So like I said, it was just an initial conversation. And I think maybe folks knew of my activism and the way I show up in communities. And so they reached out to me and that's how it started.
And if you're comfortable, could you tell me a bit about some of the lived experience or the experiences you've heard from others? Like, how does this discrimination manifest in people's lives?
If I start about myself, and my story is not unique, my experience is not unique. So me telling you about me and my experience is basically telling you about many other people that have experienced the same things. So I am an immigrant. I'm a Black woman. I'm a mother. I am in my fourth year PhD. I speak both French, English. I speak Spanish. I've had professional experience, both in the public and political sector. I worked at PMO. So my lived experiences are full. I do have a full resume, and I'm absolutely qualified and have the competencies and skills, soft and hard skills, to do the work. And even though I have all of this, I've been facing walls after walls after walls after walls and barriers, systemic barriers, and all of them telling me, well, you don't have enough skills here, or you can't do this work, or you don't have enough experiences. All these are excuses because I know what I have, I know my worth, and I also know everything that I have done. So that's one thing. And then another thing is the microaggressions, the way that you are treated as second-class citizen, even though all you want to do as a person is to contribute in making this country a better country. You want to be part of serving Canadians, helping Canadians, but you're always questioned. All of your what you want to do or what you're doing is always questioned. And often the common variable here is the color of your skin, the oppressions. And when you are a Black person, a racialized person, someone who has been put in the margins, you know when people come to attack you. You know when people are there to oppress you. Folks will try to gaslight you and say that it's all in your head. But we know our body is political. We've been living in this body for so long that we know exactly when people come at us in and their intentions are not healthy. So these are the type of experiences that we face on a daily basis, and that continue to harm us physically, mentally, spiritually, and continue to harm us in the productivity, in our productivity at work and in how we show up at work, right? And even when we work 10 times more and we have the best results, we are always questioned, and our counterparts, so our colleagues that are non-Black or non-racialized, will often move at a faster pace than we are. So these lived experiences are justified by the data out there, and the it's just in observing who is getting all of these senior management positions. It's not us most of the time. We're definitely othered.
You mentioned, this othering and the walls that you've been hitting despite, being in the middle of studying for a PhD and having all these qualifications. How does it feel for you to experience these barriers and see this happen?
So I think that I'm reminding this to myself, and I need to remind it to folks listening to us, and when I speak to people, we need to make sure we don't let them get into our heads, because when they do, then we've lost half of the battle. When we start doubting about who we are and our worth and how we make this world a better place, and when we start doubting about all the brilliant things that we can bring and we bring to our teams and into building communities, that's when they've won. When we start internalizing all of these oppressions, that's part of the whole strategy to win. So I am aware of the damage that these oppressions have done to me. And I can see also what it has done to others, living in community and seeing how it has affected others. And everybody is different, so it will manifest differently from one person to another. But that's the thing. I feel heartbroken when I witness and read about how, we know that mental health is endemic. Basically, it's everywhere, but we read that in Black population is rampant, and it's also because of the chronic stress that we experience, and that chronic stress is definitely very present in the workplace, and unfortunately, we bring it home. We bring it in our families, and our spouses experience some of it because it's hard for us to leave it at home, outside of the home or in the office, because it is so physical. Words, they come and they cut through your skin and your soul. So it's not, and then the effect, like I said, you start internalizing a lot of it. And that makes me really sad, because there's a lot of healing that needs to happen. That healing needs to be, yes, individual. However, as a collective, we're suffering a lot. So we can't forget that collective healing. So there's a lot of us walking and trying to do the best that we can, but we're doing it broken because of the way the system is set up and how the system is set up a certain way. Yeah. But the way humans perpetuate that setup and that system is another thing. And that's the part we don't, I don't know that we realize how we have a huge role to play in how this system is upheld. So it's not just the system can work as a certain way, but as people, we are just like pushing it and pushing it and pushing it. And so, that's what I would say. As a human, I'm just I feel the hurt and the pain that's in our societies, and it's not easy to experience and to be in.
So you mentioned this need for collective healing, and so I'm curious, what does this class action and I mean this work mean to you? How does it contribute to that collective healing?
So there's a movement that's called we're asking for reparation, basically, and asking for reparation is, I guess, this holistic practice of demanding for justice, not just for us as an individual, but for people that came before us and people that are coming after us, and they're growing into an inheriting of this system that's so broken. Well, not broken, that's actually working really well, but that doesn't benefit us. So that's why it is important to me. It's important to me because I just want to leave this world with something better for my children. And I just want to honor those who have walked the path before me and say, you have not done this for nothing. You have not sacrificed for nothing. I truly believe in that whole concept of a village, of the village and the community, and of this whole thing about of this concept called Ubuntu. I am because we are. So I cannot be if I know that my brother, my sister, you know, they're suffering, right? I can't just think about myself. I need to think about like further than myself. Like, and I have to look at myself as being part of, and not just, you know, on my little island. So that's why it's so important for me to fight. And my fight, or rather, if I win, we all win. Even if you are not a Black woman like me and don't have the same experiences, me fighting to demand justice on the violence that I have received is also beneficial to you. So all these fights are important because hopefully what they do is they break barriers for all, not just for some. And so these oppressions that we're fighting right now with the Black Class Action suit are specific to Black people, but many other groups in the margins can relate to some of these oppressions, right? Because they've been oppressed for maybe the color of their skin, for their sexual orientation, for because of their religion, which we have all of these intersections in the different Black communities. So this is not isolated. We're fighting for everyone, but we're demanding justice because harm has been done towards Black folks, Black public servants. And if we consider all of us being humans and caring for humans and caring for human rights, then we should also embrace that fight and join the troops and fight together.
Yeah, and I really like what you were saying about if you win, we all win. I was wondering, could you elaborate on that? Of course, the class action is still in the process of being certified, but I'm curious, you know, if it does get certified and then you win, what do you think that could do for organizing against workplace discrimination?
So when it does get certified, we still have a long road ahead of us. So we haven't quite won yet, but if it gets certified, then we're one step further, and we need to celebrate every single step because we know that they're not easy to get to, and we definitely need to celebrate in every single little joyful moment, even in this pain that we're all experiencing. So when I say when I win, we all win, or when you win, I win, I say that so if the best example I could give you is some of the movements that were created here in the Global North, like say feminist movement, for example, especially the first few waves, they were not that inclusive. They fought for women, but not women that looked like me, for example. So I think we need to learn from all these fights that included some but left a lot of others aside. Fighting for the rights of humans means that if we win, then we've already set a precedent that, hey, you know, this can actually, they realize how exclusive that is and how oppressive that is. And if folks have succeeded in making that clear or showing that it's not okay, then it might give courage to another group to say, we're going to stand up and show them that we also, as human beings, deserve better. So I think it's in that courage that we can share with others. It's in celebrating that people are recognized as people and they're giving the rights that they deserve and they should have. I think that we're trying to step away from, like, even though here we're talking about Black workers, it is important for me to remind you or to reiterate that within even all the Black communities, there's different intersections, and those intersections will touch different groups. So again, if we win, those groups win too, because they're acknowledged and they're recognized, and it's a powerful, powerful thing in itself. So I think that's what I mean by saying, like, when I win, we truly all win, especially if we believe in all of us being interconnected and all of us benefiting, right, from the abundance that the system can give us. Because right now we're not all benefiting, it's only some. And those who are don't want to share with the rest of us. And so we're saying we don't want this anymore. All of us, there's enough for all of us. And working collaboratively, working together, is actually the best case scenario, because it would allow for this country to grow, like, even better, right? So so yeah, that's what I mean when I say when you win, when I win, you win.
So before we end it off, as this story continues to develop and people continue to follow it, do you have any parting words or last kind of sentiments you want to leave people with as they continue to watch this unfold?
Thank you for asking me that question. And I think something I would like to reiterate in leaving this space tonight with you is for all of you suffering at home, for all of you experiencing oppression, discrimination, racism, for all of you who are now living with the repercussions of what microaggressions or chronic violence can do to your mental and your physical, I want to say that I see you. I believe you. We've seen in court for the past few days that they keep questioning our stories. They keep questioning our truth because to them it doesn't make sense. And the government will say that they're there to uphold the law, when we know that the law, as the way it's been written, is not always, you know, has biases, I should say. So know that those who are fighting this fight, they see you and we believe you. I see you and I believe you. And I'm holding space for each and every one of you because I know how lonely that space can be. And I want to know that I want you to know that you're worthy to be here and to be in these spaces. And that's something that, again, I said at the beginning of our interview, when they get in your head, it's when they've personally won. Because the stories that we start telling ourselves when we start believing them that we're not worthy can be horrible. And then they spiral really quickly. So I want to remind all of you that you are worthy and that I'm going to keep fighting as long as I'm granted energy and health. And this is too important for me to stop now. We're going to continue until the end, and justice will prevail. The numbers that are saying, you know, the stories are there, but also the numbers are saying it's not just happening to just me. It's happening to so many of us. So we need to keep that faith that eventually everything will be okay.
That's beautiful. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for joining us on Rabble Radio today, Bernadette.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Have a wonderful rest of your day.
Thank you. You too.
That was Bernadette Becci and Rabble Labor reporter Gabriella Kaluge-Kasuga in conversation. Thanks so much for that, Bernadette and Gabby. Switching gears now, let's review the top stories on Rabble.ca with Nick Seabrook in a segment we like to call In Case You Missed It. Over to you, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. This week is Halloween, and Rabble knows that the climate crisis and sustainability can be scary topics. But never fear, because we have 5 tips on how to be green this spooky season. Jack-o'-lanterns are a Halloween favorite, but Rabble recommends being mindful with how you decorate yours this year, so that you can dispose of it sustainably. Avoid spraying or painting your pumpkin, as this makes them impossible to safely compost. Also, if you're looking for a community-minded and sustainable way to dispose of your jack-o'-lantern after October 31st, consider donating it to a local animal rescue farm in your area. The pigs will love it. Whether it be buying local produce or secondhand costumes, there are plenty of ways to put the fear into capitalist consumerism this Halloween season. In BC politics, the results of last week's provincial election were finalized, and David Eby's NDP government has managed to hold on to power. The election was bitterly fought, with the BC Conservatives in particular running on a campaign of climate denial, conspiracy theories, and unfortunately in some cases, open racism. One such example was of BC Conservative candidate Marina Sapochnikov, who is running in the Juan de Fuca riding. During an interview with a reporter on election night, Sapochnikov stated that Indigenous peoples had no culture or language prior to European colonization, and said that Indigenous studies were, quote, all a lie, end quote. Sapochnikov later apologized for the remarks a day after a recount awarded the close race to her NDP opponent. Indigenous Rabble columnist Aaron Blondo said that Sapochnikov's attitudes were exemplary of the racism and prejudice of the far right towards Indigenous peoples. In Alberta politics, Premier Danielle Smith is doubling down on her attack on trans kids. Earlier this year, Smith announced her intention to introduce legislation restricting the rights and safety of trans youth in the province. Ahead of her party's annual general meeting in Red Deer this weekend, Smith and her ministers are signaling that they will soon be introducing legislation to block trans youth from using their correct pronouns and from accessing life-saving gender-affirming care. Earlier this month, Conservative New Brunswick Premier Blaine Higgs lost his election. Higgs was the first Conservative Premier to announce restrictions on the trans population in 2023. Alberta politics expert David Kleinenhager writes, despite Higgs' loss, Smith likely won't learn the lesson and will be undeterred. In national news, Conservative Party leader Pierre Poilievre is still trying to portray himself as someone who knows the struggles of everyday Canadians and can provide solutions, But in an op-ed on Rabble, Fareed Khan asks what a lifelong politician really knows about the working class. Polyev worked as a political staffer before being elected to the House of Commons at the age of 25. Now, as leader of the opposition, Polyev draws on an annual salary of nearly $300,000 a year, in addition to a lifetime pension. He also lives at the official residence of the leader of the opposition, Stornoway, a mansion that is fully staffed with servants and security. Fareed Khan writes, quote, Polyev's ascent to political elite status and his privileged lifestyle over the last two decades contrasts starkly with the realities faced by most voters, since he never accumulated the middle-class experience that would help him relate to the issues important to the bottom 95% of Canadians, one has to wonder how he can relate to that segment of the Canadian electorate. End quote. And finally, in environmental news, David Suzuki is writing about the importance of green space and nature in urban settings. Suzuki explains that not only does access to nature increase mental and physical health for individuals, but that it also helps to raise awareness of the impacts of the climate crisis. Not only should municipal governments be concerned about the maintenance of roads and other infrastructure, they should also see themselves as the stewards of nature. Suzuki is calling on municipalities to bring in larger green spaces and intact ecosystems into their concrete jungles. As always, you can read the full version of all the stories we talked about today on Rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. If you have feedback for the show, ideas, stories, opinions you'd like us to cover, we'd love to hear about it. Get in touch with us anytime at editor@rabble.ca. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on Rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.
And officially radio's best friend.
Hey, folks.